Today, Open Source Security welcomes back Thomas DePierre, one of my favorite people to talk about open source. So Thomas, welcome back to the show, man.
Hey, Josh. Thanks. Thank you for inviting me back.
I love talking with yourself.
You about this too. And I love listening to. Yeah, I need to welcome you to this. I don't know why. I mean, in my house, right? I'm in my house. I welcome you in my house, kind of too, right? Now awesome. That we do this stuff remotely and not in a studio.
Yeah.
Good. Miracle.
No. So Thomas reached out and you wrote a blog post, ironically, on April 1st, which makes it even funnier. But on April Fool's Day, let me zoom out.
I think it was last year, actually.
2024. Oh, holy crap. It is that old. Oh, my goodness. It feels like it was not that old.
We are old.
it's been a crazy year. But the title is, "You Are All on the Hobbyist Maintainer's Turf Now."
Yeah.
And I feel like this is, it's always been relevant, I think. But it feels like, I don't know why, but I've heard multiple times over the last probably 2 or 3 months, a number of people saying things like, oh, most open source developers are paid to work on the things they work on. And so you were like, hey, we should talk about this. And I'm like, yes, it is absolutely the right time to talk about this. So I'll give you the floor. Explain to us kind of what this is all about.
Right. Anger, mostly. That's what my blog posts are about, anger management. But I think that it's a strategy that is pretty easy. You destroy nothing, you just write words, no one reads them. Pretty nice. I think my personal thing, right? I am a maintainer. If you want to know more about me and what I do, you can go to previous podcasts with me on this podcast. Previous iterations, but I think the reality there is that there is a lot of maintainers, right? I know you recorded a podcast like a few weeks or months ago. I don't know it is with you with your schedule, right? But around the ecosystems data. And the thing that is mentioned there is that there are millions of maintainers. Right. And we don't know all of them, right? And we don't count everyone that commits some stuff and all, but we know there are millions of them. And we don't see their life a lot, right? We don't know a lot of stuff about them when you are not one and talking in this kind of places.
Yes.
And it's pretty, and a feeling we have had in this year, quarterly, I have had, and we have talked a bit with friends that are, small maintainers too and all, is that this is probably most of the open source out there. And by most of the open source, I do not mean most of the open source if you take into account all the packages that are just a version 0.1 or never used anywhere, right? But also most of them if you take the stuff that is actually in use.
Yes.
And I wrote the blog post because I finally got some data that followed that, right? So it's not data from me, right? Not data I collected, and it's data from different sources that you should probably not combine the way I did, but it's good enough to get a taste or an idea of what's happening there.
Yes.
And it's data from two different reports. The first one is from, I think it was Synergy. Sonatype. The Sonatype one was they look at how much open source is used in the real world, right? Like in proprietary code base and stuff like that, how much is it used? And the second one, and we'll come back to that. And the second one is from, what are the names? The ones that paid maintainers? Tidelift, right. I like them on top of that. Louis is a great guy. And Tidelift talks more about how many, who are the maintainers, right? What are their problems? What do they deal with? Who are they in a demographic and professional way? And if you look at these two data sets, there are two things that come out for me. The first one is that nearly every single code base out there use open source. And by nearly, I think it's 95 or 99, like something like that, in the high 90s percent of proprietary code base like stuff. Use open source.
Right. So the Sonatype report you reference, it's a 77%, but I've seen many reports claiming it's in the 90s now.
So I think what they claim is that 77% of code in code base out there is open source, but 90-something percent of code bases use some open source.
Okay, that's fair.
So, and so, basically, open source is everywhere, and open source is also nearly everything.
Right, it's a huge number either way. Right,
but what that also means is that, and that's what I keep saying, is that open source won. There's no fight to be done anymore. Right, yeah. Like nearly every single code, like line of code out there being used in a product, commercial or not, is open source, like at least 3/4 of it and growing.
Yeah, yeah.
And growing fast, like we are getting percentage every year at least. So like this is going fast. So that's a lot of code. And the stuff that come from, and it's mostly open source, we won. There is no battle to be fought, right? If you are fighting for open source to become the dominant, that's done. We are in a different era now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think that's actually the discourse we are having in these places. Yeah. And the second aspect is from the Tidef report. So they have a number that says that something like 70% of maintainers are unpaid.
I've got it right here.
Yeah.
So you said, I just have your post notes. Yeah. So that's what I'm, and there will be a link to this.
And I should have the link in the blog post anyway to them.
But it says 60% of maintainers describe themselves as unpaid hobbyists. 13% are, they are professionals but aren't paid to work on open source. And 23% are
semi-professionals. 30% are paid to work on open source full time. Most or all of their income for 13%.
Right.
Maintaining projects. Yeah.
Yes.
And 23% is part time. Right.
Right. Right. Some income. Yes.
Keep in mind that part time can be a really low bar. something we can come back later. And that means that at least 60 to 83%, depending on where you count, are not full time maintainers. Right.
Right.
And 60% are fully unpaid. Now, the other thing to keep in mind is that this is Tidef. The people they reach are going to be slightly more in the I am a paid professional or partially paid professional category.
Yes. Yes.
Because of what they are doing. They are paying people for doing this, so that's normal, they get that, right? So if we combine these two sets, and we shouldn't, don't do it like that. This is purely wet finger trying to guesstimate stuff. It means that something between 40 to 50% of all code in product actually in use out there, like the stuff running the world that is actually in use, not just stuff someone typed for fun, is hobbyist maintained, right? And if we add to that the, you know, I sometimes get a bit of pocket money for my code, which is probably what the semi-professional mean, right? Partially part-time paid. It's more pocket money than real, you know, full-time, that real job. We get past 50%. And yes, there is a lot of caveats here in what I'm saying. The error bar are massive. It doesn't matter. Right? We are already at something like, even if you are really conservative, a third of code out there being like that is actually used, being a base maintainer. And I'm being conservative here. That's a lot.
Yes.
And that's not how we talk about it.
No.
Right? Because it means that if we want to have impact on open source, right, being security, you know, having better security, or having code that is done better, or having code that is more resilient, where, you know, we have someone to act if we need something to change, like all that stuff, the main people we target are hobbyists, and we don't know who they are and what they do and how they work, and we know nothing.
That's correct. Yes.
So, and I don't think, and that's my feeling, and that's shared with auto maintainers, that what we see as initiative in this direction, like the direction of wanting to influence or help or come, you know, be part of open source, are made in the mindset that the vast majority of the stuff is hobbyist and that need to fit with the hobbyist mindset and constraints and realities. And that's what I end with anger, but that was a long time ago. My anger, I mean, it's not gone away, but I can manage it better now. It is like, before offering things, right, before offering help, before trying a scheme you have in your head that may help, or that you think will make things better, you really need to sit down and do the product research or the user research to understand this demographic. Because otherwise, and that's what we are seeing a lot, what you're going to offer is not going to help or even to be done. I think that was, there was a tweet somewhere, like I should search it, from someone that was at the OpenSSF, right? Open Source Security Foundation, saying they had millions to spend on open source security and they couldn't find a way to spend it.
Yes, I remember that.
Right? And I should go find it, but what that may tell me is you have a product market fit problem. Your product, your money, the way you are trying to spend your money on what you think it would be going to help doesn't fit the people that do this, doesn't fit the market, what people that do this need or can do or can accept.
Yes.
Right? Okay. And that's when you start to look at the open source initiatives that exist with that lens, you start having nightmares at night, but that's okay. That's my life.
Right.
So yeah, that's the thing I think. And the reason I you know, contacted you again to try to use this one was that Pradreg was working on cargo semver checks, yep. Right? Yep. You interviewed him in your podcast a few episodes ago, said something like he's paid, right, for by all kind of complexities and source to work on this. Now he's not paid a lot of money, and he mentioned numbers, which is rare actually. People that are paid even part time in open source rarely mention numbers, even if it was just in passing, but it did. And he mentioned a thing which is like, it needs to be a career. If you want this, if you want to give money to people and all, and you want them to be able to take the money, it needs to be something you can make a career of. And it needs to be something that I think he mentioned is the cost of his house, right? His mortgage or his rent. I think he mentioned his rent. And yes. Like, yeah, nice. You are giving me that amount of money. My rent is four times that.
That's right. Yep. Yep.
In that case, like, and that's I think is, and maybe we can talk about that and you can ask questions or wonder or think with me, like, how do we find out and communicate? What is it to be an OBS maintainer? What do we do? How it is? Like, and then people may be able to try to find way to help us that fit into that.
Right. Right. Okay. That is a lot to unwind.
Yes.
Like a lot. So yeah. I want to start with something you have in your post here, which is kind of near the end, where you mention the old guard, the people who did open source in like the 90s and early 2000s, which is obviously where I come from as well. What we experienced is not what's going on today. And that's the thing, like, I always find myself being like, oh, well, that's not how it works. And then I have to say, no, Tama would yell at me. What would Tama do? And then I try to listen and learn, because that I think is more important and interesting than anything else. And I think this comes back to your OpenSSF comment, is I would, from my experience, the OpenSSF is primarily filled with people who know open source from the 90s and early 2000s. They don't know open source today.
Yes, and they may also know open source because I have looked at who is on the board of the OpenSSF, and they probably know open source from a point of view of companies that are large, like big enterprise,
yes, that too,
that found open source. They do have people that are paid full time by them to work on Linux, to work on maybe they pay Red Hat. Like, there is a lot of people in this company. There is a lot of people that are paid to work on open source, and so to them, that's the world they see, that's the open source they see, right? Like, I code a lot in Elixir and Erlang for my personal, you know, like, professional life. Erlang is maintained by the team paid by Ericsson. Ericsson is a big telco company. If I work at Ericsson as someone that do, you know, software security or something like that, what I know about open source is that there is a paid team working on this language. If I work at Google, what I see is a paid team working on Go and probably C++. I think they have a lot of people that are paid to work on C++, on Linux, and Linux kernel, all kind of stuff like that. That's if I work at Oracle, I see people paid to work on Java, because I think Oracle still have people paid to work on Java, right? So you do have this lens of seeing these people. In the same way, if you are part of the, well, what I call the old guard here, because, you know, it's also true, is that part of the fight you fought, and that was a fight, right? I'm not going to, like, that was not easy, yes. Right? I'm not dismissing that experience, right? It's true, it happened. Was also building foundations and stuff like that, and the people you see are the people that were paid enough to stay that long, to stay this year. And so what, and that's something I experienced when I went to, especially to force them, when I went to force them to try to be in the room with the European Commission, right? The European Union Commission, when there were people from the Commission that came in to try to talk around open source, at the time mostly about the CRA, but not only. There were also discussion around the DMA, right? And how, for example, what Apple was doing in terms of opening or not the ecosystem. Like, there was a lot of discussion around this stuff. So, like, there are discussions. And you will also see people explain how they are trying to, you know, use OpenOffice of Linux for desktop at the Commission or stuff like that to try to fight back the evil Microsoft. Like, you will see all that stuff, right? To a maintainer like me, And I ask in the room, and it was recorded, so I think you can go search and force them for the recording of that. You can see me. I ask in the room during questions, with your hand, if you are not paid to be in that in this room, like it is not your job to be in this room.
How many?
And this was. Force them is free. It's open source people that came to here. Like, I'm not saying this is, you know, corporate lobbyists. No. This is open source people. People that work with foundations, that pay open source people, that developers, this is people. They are lobbyists, but paid by the foundation. Like, it's not people that come from, you know, whatever. I was the only person that raised my hand.
Wow. That's worse. I expected five or less, but one is terrible.
Is there maybe one other person? But I think it was me and maybe one other person was not too sure. Now, I am not saying this is, you know, like they are bad people. It's great and we need them too. But what it means that people in these rooms are the people that know the 13 persons that get paid, right? They are the people that grew up when the fight was around OpenOffice.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
That's right.
Around Play Store, Google Play Store, around, you know, the GPL being a virus, right? Like this, but this was real fight. This was real stuff that happened, right?
Yeah.
The thing is, we ended up not winning through that way.
Right, right.
We didn't, exactly. Open Source did not win through OpenOffice. I mean, LibreOffice now, LibreOffice, I suppose now, but still, yeah, right? Yeah. Or we did not win through Audacity or all that stuff, right? We won through the bottom. By replacing the entire bottom.
Exactly, yes.
And so all that experience you had, all this view you had, that's not the world we live in now. And so it warps things because these are the people that are in the room, they are the way they think about it. And that's not a bad thing. Like, I'm not saying they're bad for having this thing or having felt this, it's just that it's probably slightly out of place now with the reality we deal with, right? And that's where listening comes in.
I want to add one piece to this as well, is if you look at a lot of the companies that are, we'll say, selling open source, and I'll use the word selling loosely, it is, they're clearly selling to that demographic, and they're clearly riding the can you trust all these weirdos horse, because that is like the message, right? Oh, you can't trust open source, but you can trust me. And it's like, I don't know about this.
I mean, yeah, the thing is, the money they get is not money they would have gotten anyway. Like, they are feeling a different need, right? It's a need of security, of wanting to feel safe. And so that's okay. I have more, the part that really struck me was that outside that room, I was talking with someone from Ireland that was working for a foundation, right? Like a European open source foundation or free software foundation, I don't remember which one, something like that, right? And what he told me is that they thought it was time finally, like there was, you know, impetus and all to do an open, like a free software, an open source software bill in Europe. I'm like, okay, what do you want in it? Say, oh, what we would like in it is that we would like things like, imagine if in Google Play Store, there would be an icon next to your name that tell you if it's proprietary or open source, so that people know where to choose. So they can pick the game that is open source or the game that is proprietary or the thingy. And I'm like, okay, so I understand why you think about that. I understand where you come from, right? This is a time of, is it LibreOffice or Linux or versus Microsoft, right?
Yes.
That's
yes.
Great. Also, my man, I'm sorry, but you are from the past and that's not the reality. Well, like, that's not going to help anyone. And that's also not important. That fight doesn't matter anymore. It's not how we won. It's not where it come. And at the other hand, I don't know anyone in there that talks about packages, package repositories.
No.
Right?
Well, it depends what you define. So when I say the word packages, it used to mean like Red Hat RPMs or Debian Debs or whatever. But when I say the word packages now, I mean like using NPM, right? Using PyPy, using, you know, Cargo or
programming language.
Like, yeah, that's what I see now. I don't even think about like Debian packages in that context anymore.
Yes. I mean, it's probably not the place for this, but I think that's part of the old guard discussion too, right? Like these packages existed for two different purposes, one of them being shipping the shrink wrap product to the user, right? And that's the part where we did not win. And the other one was shipping C dependencies.
Yes.
Because C never got a package manager. I mean, you are loafing, but that's true, right?
It is.
And C++, the thing is now, and Perl kind of add one, but they don't really like it, like all that stuff, right? But now what we're seeing with the distro is that when they have to bring programs written with the Rust is a visible one, but they're all like Python and all have the same problem, right? When they need to bring program in this distro package manager that use this programming language package manager, it doesn't work really well. It's really, really painful.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Right.
Which is why no one uses it, right? It's why containers won, literally.
Yeah,
they
kind
can just ignore all that.
I would, no, I think there's
we'll
another
argue
reason.
We'll argue that another
but,
day.
Yeah. So to go back to this, like, yeah, this old guard is there and this thing differently, right? And so, and that's, there are the people in the room for policy. And there are the people that have access to this money that we're seeing. And that's also why we see, I think, part of this discrepancy between these announcements or the policies that are offered and the reality that, like, they do not, there is a transmission problem in the middle. Like, the clutch is not engaging. Like, there is all these pollen things they want to do, and in the real world, is basically nothing, right? I'm thinking of the OpenSSF as a typical example, right? I think you are the one that keep bringing back this issue with, we want to say how many maintainers should you have for a package, right?
Yep.
I think I talked in that issue in a couple one, and I think they never acknowledged the data you brought.
No. It meant nothing to anyone.
It just fizzled. More,
yeah. Well, of course it did, because the answer was inconvenient, so they just ignored it.
Right. But the problem, and that's part of why we keep having this clutch problem where we cannot, like, there are all these kind of policies and people that try stuff and foundation and think tank and all these offers, and none of it translate into results. It's because the truth, the reality is too different from the model for this policy, and we just inconveniently don't want to deal with it.
So there's some of that, I think, but I'll say there's also an aspect of, I think there are people who genuinely want to help, but they don't know what to do.
I think it's more than don't know what to do. I think they don't know what to do because they don't understand what the problem is.
For sure. Yes.
Right? I can try to explain what it is from my point of view of being an OBS maintainer, right?
Yes. And we should also add the caveat that
Oh, it's me.
This is about you, yeah. But every open source developer, every open source project is like its own special snowflake. And so what's going to work for Thomas de Pierre may not work for someone else.
I have no idea what would work for me. What right. I can describe is a problem, not the solution. And I think that's kind of the thing here, right? We are not describing the problem. And that's, so let's see, for example. So right now, for the few packages I maintain, and the few stuff I do, to give an idea for some people, I am probably right now the expert on string to float conversion. Float to string conversion on the Erlang ecosystem. That sounds really niche. It is.
Yeah.
But we, by speeding up that algorithm, it's not from me. Someone else figured out how to do it. I figured out how to implement it into the runtime and all. And I was paid for that, and we'll come back to that. I probably cut down something like 1-2% consumption over all the Erlang ecosystem of power, right? Computing power and electricity, every time you do JSON with float. That's cool. A low number, but once you scale it around the numbers of time you generate or read or generate JSON across the whole ecosystem, you get a significant impact. Now, I'm not here to do that to gloat, but to give an idea of what kind of niche things have impact that we would probably
found. I want you to gloat a little bit, because what a lot of people don't understand is Erlang is used heavily in the telecommunications industry. So it is highly likely that all of us during our day run through your code at least once, probably many more times.
More than that, right. WhatsApp is Erlang on the back end.
Oh, I didn't know that. So there you go.
Since the first day, that's how they scaled with so few people. If your kids use Discord, Discord
hey,
is
I use Alex. Discord. I'm not that old.
You know, but you probably don't use it as much as them. It's LXM's backend, which is an Erlang with a shiny bit of stuff on top. So yes, it's used, and you probably don't see it, but it's there.
Yes.
And so so that's the kind of stuff that have impact, right? But it's niche, it's super nerdy, like there's maybe less than 100 people in the world that can understand what I'm talking about if I even try to talk about this, like stuff like that, right? Now, I spend probably something like 1-2 hours a month on my maintenance ship for all the package I have. In that time, what I can do most of the time is update dependencies, fix the build system, because it probably broke due to some kind of update of Ubuntu.
Obviously.
Right. I have a few of the stuff I manage that use like web stuff. Like they have a graphic interface using web stuff, which means that I'm probably going to, on these 2 hours per month, I'm probably going to spend 4 hours doing CSS updates. Yes, I'm not. Yes. I know the numbers do not add up. I know.
CSS, yo. It's fine.
Right? Or NPM updates on Node stuff like that for assets. And so this is, and then maybe sometimes I may have a couple hours per year where I can write code that is not just pure maintenance of dependencies.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's my reality. Now, the other part of my reality, if I got paid to work on this float to string conversion. I offered this as a grant, and I got paid something like $5,000 at the time, I think, something around that. You can find it, it's public. The Erlang Ecosystem Foundation are the ones that founded that, it's public. And I worked on this something like 10 hours a week for 6 months. Now, the reason I could do that is because it was the end of the pandemic, and I was out of a real job, and I didn't have any contract, and so it was just fun stuff. And so I was paid, but I would have done it even not paid, right? The reality is, before I did that grant, I spent 6 months reading about this and learning how to do it and learning how to all that stuff and all, right? So like you... And so that's a huge part of being an OBS maintainer, is that you do deep niche stuff. And that means, at least for me, and that means that I spend a lot of time upfront thinking about it in my shower, where I do something else, when I walk, or maybe sometimes I will read a paper and then a year later I will do something with it, or years later, right? And so there is only a few hours of code and a lot of time spent doing that kind of stuff. Now, the other aspect of this is that I am paid full time to work on software, right? I'm a software developer, among other things. And I have a house with a mortgage, and I have food to buy. And I don't know if you know that, but the software engineer marketplace is not great for part-time work.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. Right? Like it's full-time or nothing. Or contract. But if you do contract, you have all kind of other things because you need to spend time managing your clients and finding new ones and all that stuff. So there is a lot of work there. What that means is if someone come out tomorrow wanting to pay me a grant to work on this stuff a bit more, I can't.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
I can't. I can't find time to do that. So, and I think that the aspect is what I do today is mostly a few hours every month doing updates and a few thinking and being interested in this stuff. That's my life as a hobbyist. And I think that's relatively representative of a lot of hobbyist maintainers, right? Not everyone, but a lot of them are probably something akin to that.
Yes. Yes.
Like Eggsy come to mind or stuff like that, where we don't really want to think about it sometime and then we have to. And then I've got 3 months where I was stressed by my personal life and I opened my laptop and I discovered that I have 10 hours of updates fixing to do. And that's part of what being a maintainer is, right?
Yes.
So that's what it is. And the other aspect, I think, is what's the constraint if you want to help me do that?
Yes. Right. Because I see that all the time where if you show up to a project and you might send them a pull request.
Yeah.
And then it can turn into you get ignored or they get annoyed because it doesn't match the style or whatever. Yeah. The mess. There's a million things, right? And it is hard.
And like, even if I have no problem with your pull request when I want it, I will probably not see it.
For sure. Yeah.
Like I'm probably going to log into GitHub to check that stuff among all the notifications I get for my job. I will probably see it in 6 months when I finally have time to go look at my open source repo, right? And at that point, I will look at it and be like, oh yeah, that's a security fix. Or I will try to bring it in. I just need to update all this stuff first. So I will probably merge it in 3 to 6 months.
Yep.
Right? Or the build doesn't work anymore, so I can't validate your stuff. So let me fix that first. Let's see what GitHub Action did in the meantime. And then maybe we can. And that's how you end up with a 6 months to a year timeline to merge a security fix. And so it's not even that we ignore you, it's just that we have life. And this is our hobby when we have time, right? And we have a lot of things that eat that time, right? Predrag talked about this, right? How Cargo Saver Checks was there because imagine all the time lost trying to update when it breaks and not knowing. Yep. And Predrag talked about that in the view mostly of the enterprise. Right, where your developers spend time and you stop updating and all. But from the hobbyist maintainers, that's most of your job. That most of the stuff you do. It's updating the build systems, dependencies, the stuff like that. That's most of what you need to do. It's a constant treadmill. And if you can reduce the time it takes there, oh my, how many things could I do? Right? And that's why also I think people don't realize why hobbyist maintainers love Rust.
That's a good point, actually. I hadn't really thought about that angle, but yeah, Rust solves a bunch of those problems. And it just
compared
makes
to
disappear.
C?
Yeah, oh my goodness.
Like, you can't even unit test.
Everything solves problems.
Yeah, but that's the thing, right? We talk about the memory safety. We talk about this stuff about Rust. From an hobbyist maintainer's perspective, I can have unit test. That's it. I have cargos that actually can bring a package. I don't have to fight with all the distros. And every time they change the way they do it, it breaks the way I bring my C dependencies. I need it, right? Like I actually, and that's why we see all these package repositories, like for package managers, for languages, is because the obvious maintainers need that to be able to do that job. So if you look at it this way, that maybe help, you know, get an idea of what are the kind of things we want. Right, same thing, the compiler tell you where the error is. Like the Rust compiler actually tells you.
The Rust.
You don't have to spend 5 hours debugging, it tells you.
Right, yes.
As a hobbyist, I just multiplied my productivity by tenfold just because instead of having to spend my hobby time during 6 months debugging this thing, I can do it in one session.
Okay, so here's how we should finish this one up.
Yeah.
I don't want to run on too long. We'll just have you back to maybe continue this. But so you're talking about this from a very hobbyist perspective of you don't want to get paid.
Oh, no,
just
I want
don't
to.
Want more work. You still.
Okay, oh, no, so I would love to get paid.
Okay.
But I will finish on this then, and I will keep it relatively short and we can maybe expand on this later. I would love to be paid. Here's the thing. If you want to pay me, I need stability.
Right, right.
And sufficient income to pay for my lifestyle.
Right, that's right. Yes. Yeah, it can't be $5,000. Right.
I mean, can be, but per month. But the thing is, like, and it cannot be a 6 months or 1 year thing.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And I think that's the thing we fail to realize. I have a mortgage, which means that I need to pay every month. I don't have a choice. I mean, I do, but it's not a good choice. Right. And that means also, and I have a stable job with a stable French law contract, right? Which means that you can't fire me easily. And the other aspect is, despite that, I know I will probably change job every 3 to 5 years maximum, because that's the industry we are in. Now, that means searching for a new job is a 3 months to 6 months full-time job.
Yes, yes.
So if you offer me a 1 year grant, that will cover my needs for you, right? It's big enough to cover equivalent of an income as a salary for my profession for a year. I would still not take it.
Yeah, for sure.
Because it means that I'm going to spend 3 to 6 months of this year hoping to find a new job. And if things go wrong, and I have some friends that are in this situation right now because the market's not great, I am dry with nothing at the end of that grant.
That's right. Yep, yep.
So the problem is, I would love to be paid, but the sums, like the amount needed for it to make sense for me, I'm nowhere close to what we offer right now.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Also, I am not sure someone would want to offer it, because I am not sure there is enough work in the stuff I maintain right now to fill a full-time job.
And I have a suspicion there are a lot of hobbyist projects that fall under that umbrella, where
exactly,
it would
right.
be very hard to justify a full-time job.
Right. And I mean, I'm not even sure Daniel Steinberg is full-time on Curl. And he may be now, but I don't think he is.
He is now, I believe.
He is now, because he used to be part-time, I mean, a lot of time, but Wolf SSL used to pay him to do part-time that. I don't know if he's full, but like, we are talking of an extreme case here with Daniel. I love Daniel, and I appreciate him and all, but like, he's an extreme case, right? And so we cannot, like, and that's what I mean when I say that this is not how we are talking of the problem, right? We are talking of how can we give money to these people. I'm like, you can't. I mean, it's not that they don't want it, but like, once you put the reality, you know, all the parts together and paint the pictures, you're like, that's not going to work. So what's going to work? That's what I'm interested in, instead of keeping banging my head on this. Like, what's the problem? What are the problems, the real problems, the things that limits the ability, like that are breaks on the ecosystem becoming better, right? On the people being more efficient, the productivity, you can look at a lot of ways at this. And then that's what I mean with this whole, you know, you are on the obvious stuff now, right? We need to start looking at our world of open source through the lens of the obvious are our users. They are if you want to help, like, the obvious are the people you need to target if you want impact. And that means that you need to deeply understand the constraints. And that may mean that a lot of the solution you may have, that you may discover you don't have solutions right now, or that they are not palatable. On the other hand, and I will be a bit hopeful here, we have someone like Predreg and Cargos and Vetchex, or the team working on Cargo, or the Rust team itself, are definitely things that, even if maybe it was not by design, but I think it was partly by design, do help unlock some of stuff in these service maintainers. And the results are great, right? I don't remember, who was it? Was it you, someone else, that discovered RipGrep recently? Burn Sushi, Rip, Grep, and RG.
That doesn't ring a bell.
Oh, well, then you are in for a surprise. Go search for it. It's basically AG, you know, the Silver Bullet search, like Grep, for the command line.
Right.
Better, 10 times faster.
Interesting. I do run in Grep Rust. A lot. Oh,
nice. And like better. And it's an old thing, like everyone, I mean, for example, VS Code use it under the hood for the search, but it's everywhere, but it's Bun Sushi did that, and Bun Sushi has all kind of stuff, but like this is the kind of stuff you get, right? Or Asahi Linux, right? Or all this stuff you see around Rust with tool written in Rust for your shell and that stuff. It doesn't come from nowhere for no reason that suddenly everyone managed to do amazing things, right? So we have an example that it works. And so that's, I think, where we end is like, I would love to be paid. We all would love to be paid. The reality doesn't seem to align with this being realistic for now. Maybe it is, but in that case, you need the people that are interested in helping need to start with the obvious maintainers' constraints and problems and situation in mind and start there. Listen, learn, look at what we do, maybe do it a bit, like go sit behind someone's shoulder while they do it. Talk with them, you can offer them a coffee, they would probably be happy to shoot the shit on this, right? Or go in, I mean, it's not IRC anymore, but Zulip, Discord, Slack, like find the place where they are and observe what they say and how they say it. And then from that, we will probably get solutions. Hey, look at how full I am for a pessimist.
No, this is good. This is really good. This is not the sort of advice I've heard many times in the past. I think in a lot of companies especially, their solution is just write a big fat check to some foundation and then say, good job, everyone, we did it.
And the foundation do a different job.
Yes.
They do something different.
Exactly.
Right.
Right.
Like the Linux Foundation, most of its budget doesn't go to developers.
No.
And that's not a bad thing. They have a different job, and that's written on their website, right? It's not hidden. Like, it's the Apache Foundation doesn't pay developers. That's written in big bold letters on their website and on the on what they do. It's not their job.
Right. Right. That's right. But I think there is an expectation. It is funny because I know I ran into someone a couple months ago that thought the Linux Foundation was paying all of the open source developers. And I'm like, holy cow, no. I don't even know where to start with that one. But
the foundation is one of the challenges. Different. Yeah. If you ever want to see salt, real salt and bad shit, take hobbyist maintainers like me, put us in a room and make us talk about what we think of the Linux Foundation.
It's, I can imagine,
not going to be pretty. And all the CNCF. Oh gosh, the CNCF. Like, you are going to get really bad stuff because it's not our world.
That's right.
It's a different one. And that's okay. We are not represented in the room. And that's because we don't have time. We're obeyed. Right?
Well, yes.
The problem is that the obeyed are now the ones that keep the world running. Oops.
Yes, but you are right. And maybe, I mean, that's almost certainly part of a solution is the regulators need to make sure they understand and talk to people like you.
I mean, maybe.
I think they have to understand it, because if they don't, they're going to make a mess.
Oh, no. We just ignore it. What can they do?
Well, that's true. Well, you can ignore it.
Yes, but we're the ones that do everything. Like, yeah. that's another part of this, and that's probably something for another discussion. But like, what are you going to do? Are you going to put us in prison? Sure. It's not going to make the code more maintained. Like, what are you going to do? You have no pressure point on us.
We don't know. And look, I think this is one of the things, and we'll talk about this another day.
Yeah.
But like, the CRA has carve out, so the hobbyist developers don't have to deal with this crap, right?
I mean, and Gina Sterley did not put that carve out when she was talking about CISA legal liability runs, but that's old now. We cannot forget everything about that stuff. But the reality is that even if it was not carved out in there, what are you going to do?
Right. Exactly.
Like, exactly. Okay, we are liable. Okay, so what? We stop coding because we can't take the liability? Good. Do you really want all that code out there to not be maintained anymore? Because I'm happy if that's what you want, but I don't think that's what you want.
Right, exactly.
Yes. Right, like, there is no... That's interesting for another time, but the reality is, like, we can walk out.
Right, just take it out of your
pay,
right?
You don't want that walk out to happen.
No, no, for sure. For sure. Absolutely.
Like, and when I say that with a people will die in my voice. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, imagine XZ if the maintainers couldn't come back. Right?
Yes.
Exactly. Right? Imagine if, I mean, the Leftpad guy wrote a blog post today with his own, you know, years after point of view on it. I will link it if you want to look at it after. Leftpad is still a really, really painful, like, hot point between our base maintainers. Every package manager repository out there for Lang programming language, I have a stipulation in this that you cannot yank out code.
Yeah.
Once you have put it there, it has to stay forever.
Right, right.
Why?
Well,
why did we make...
It'll break
and
their customers.
That's your problem.
Right. Well, because they don't want to break their customers, which are the people
first of all, it's not really customers.
That, right?
Most of the time, it just users. There's a difference because they don't pay.
Customers in quotes.
Yeah, but that's a real big deal because we're talking about beasts here. And the second thing is, sure, but also, like, the reason they could do that is what else could we do?
Right.
And so the discussion here is why, for example, are your package manager or is there no tools for the customers to be able to have cache that makes sense locally or to have a copy of this? It's not that much data, or it's not that it's text. It's not that big stuff. It's not that big of a deal in terms of size, right? Like, why couldn't AWS offer you a cache of this?
I mean,
right?
Some of them do.
Yes, but that's kind of what I mean, right? Why do we expect from package managers that honestly are a losing money business to keep this forever and to force people, once they have put their code in there, to never be able to take it back?
That is a conversation for another day that I have many thoughts on, and I think I have the answer to, and it's who's writing the checks to the foundations, but that's another discussion.
I think there's another aspect, which is would people die if that happened?
Yeah, probably.
I mean, yes, Leftpad could have killed people, because imagine if you have to have an emergency thing that you can only book through a website that need FPS and that need Leftpad.
Yeah.
Done.
Yeah.
Like, imagine middle of COVID when everyone goes to this website to take their vaccine to be able to find it, and Leftpad is yanked and all this website fail. That's an overreach. I am not going in a full, you know, impossible scenario here. Right? And so the reality is that we decided, because we're all this, but we still are engineers and we care about this, that we will not do that because, like, no, we keep the world running. But, like, where is the regulator around package managers?
Well, I mean, the CRA, we'll see. But yeah. Okay.
No.
All right.
But yeah, that's another discussion. But we should talk. Yes. Next discussion, what we'll talk about is the impact of this kind of stuff on funding and this. Let's do that.
For sure. Absolutely. Like this is holy crap. Every time I talk to you, I feel like I know nothing and I've learned an enormous amount. So,
but also, nothing surprises you is what I say.
No, it doesn't.
Right?
Well, I mean,
you know nothing, but you actually knew it.
But even
without that, right? When I explain to people, this is what my hobbyist life is, updating package, and that I have a job and that it takes all my time, and like none of this is something new to people. They just don't put it together in this way.
Sure.
But like, I'm not surprised. Like, this is not like a, oh my God, this is how you do it. Like when you go into an eldritch part of C and discover what they do. That's not that. So yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, thank you.
No, thank you, man. Holy cow. I love it. All right, Tamar. Until next time.
Thank you
so much.
Bye bye, everyone.